Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. Where is the property market heading in the UK? It's a big question and predictions are notoriously difficult amidst Brexit uncertainty. In this programme, we will be discussing some of the factors and their possible impact. The sluggish UK economy, global developments, taxation and regulation, the politics of housing and landlord and developer sentiment. And with me in the studio are Lawrence Bowles, who's research analyst at Savills, Meera Chinduroy, policy and public affairs manager at the National Landlords Association, and Richard Bowser, who is editor of Property Investor News. Now, let me start with you first of all, Lawrence. What are the latest patterns in house prices across the UK? I see, looking at the ONS figures, that house prices were up 0.8% in the 12 months to August 2018, but that's kind of across the UK, isn't it? So what can you tell us?
That is a national average, yeah. So looking at the national picture, house price growth is at just 0.8% according to the ONS. That's slowed quite considerably over the last year, and we think that's largely, that slowdown at a national level is largely as a result of that Brexit political uncertainty. Looking at the regional picture, though, it's very different. You've got, on the one hand, robust levels of growth in Wales and Yorkshire, for instance. So Wales house price growth of 4.3% in the year to June, 3.1% growth in Yorkshire and the Humber. But that's been very much balanced out by price falls in London and the South East, where mortgage affordability is still the constraining factor in driving house price growth there.
Now, I've heard you talk about this kind of north-south cycle where the south and southeast sort of falls back and the north surges ahead a bit. And then we expect that to kind of swap around in, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years. I mean, are we on that sort of trajectory, Lawrence? I know it's very hard to make predictions, but
the way the market looks at the moment, the north still has quite some way to go yet. But you know, we'd expect to see that cycle continuing through future years as well. So we'd expect to see continued strength in the north. We might not expect to see falls in London and the southeast to continue for much longer, especially as we see some emerging political certainty coming out as a result of the flex tension that we've just seen agreed, and any further sort of developments from there. But you know, certainly for the near future, the next few years, we'd expect to see that outperformance of the North and Midlands relative to London.
And patterns in terms of rental increases. I looked at the ONS figures and rents are up by 1.3% across the UK in the 12 months to August. I mean, I've heard agents saying that the last couple of years have been the first time that they've seen the rental market and the housing market slow down, certainly in London and the South East. What do you think of the prospects there for rents?
So the first thing to remember with that ONS rental data is that it is based on a survey of rents paid rather than new rents agreed. So it moves much more slowly than you might perceive the rental market if you're looking at, you know, the lets that you're agreeing on your properties, or if you're looking at Rightmove, for instance. That being said, you know, we're still seeing much slower levels of growth, particularly in London, than we have seen before. London's rental growth has been very weak for quite some time. As late as February this year, rental growth in London was just 0.2%, and that was, you know, recovering from negative growth from rental falls in London over the last sort of 2017-18. That's back up to 0.8% growth in the year to August, so we're seeing some recovery there, but it's still a lot slower than the national average, and it's a lot slower than the growth that we're seeing at a national level in, say, house prices. So we're seeing that affordability really taking hold there as well.
And Richard Bowser, I've heard you speak at the Property Investor show recently about cities that stand out. Of course, you know, the UK property market is very much a market of micro markets in many ways. And I looked with dread at what was going on in Aberdeen, but then there were plenty of places that were actually booming. So what can you tell us about what's going on in particular cities around the UK?
Yeah, Lawrence has already said clearly the divergence between London and the North, but somewhere in the middle we've got the Midlands. And certainly in more recent years, certainly the West Midlands and the East Midlands markets have been performing reasonably strongly, not double-digit growth each year in terms of average house prices, but performing a lot better than perhaps they were doing 6 or 7 years ago, post the recession, etc. The question is, how long is this, you know, in the Midlands, where I'm struggling to remember the exact numbers, but perhaps there's been a 15 to 20% net rise, if you take away the inflation over that period. So average prices, say, across Birmingham, parts of the Midlands might be up 45% from 2008. But of course, you've got to take away 25% worth of compounded inflation over that period. So they're still 20% ahead, you know, a couple of percent per year. How long is that going to continue? How does that relate to average earnings and expectations in the future? And that's what will dictate whether the Midlands markets have peaked in the way that perhaps the London market peaked 3-4 years or so ago.
Meera, I wanted to ask you about the impact that mortgage regulation is having on the buy-to-let market and, in a sense, the impact it's having on landlord sentiment. I was looking at recent NLA research and it tells us that 26% of landlords are thinking of divesting properties within the next 12 months, but only 14% are increasing. And I know in the past we've seen figures like 60% of landlords saying they're finding it harder to get a mortgage. What sort of sentiment are you picking up?
I think there's a mix amongst landlords at the moment, just general concern about the market and letting properties and what the future is for buy-to-let, in addition to the sort of stringent requirements of mortgage lenders. I think it's a mix of those issues which are leading to landlords being much more cautious about expanding their portfolios or increasing the number of properties that they're buying in the future because they just don't know what the future holds.
And I've bumped into a few landlords at landlord meetings where they've kind of had quite a sour expression on their face and they've said that the level of regulation is just really getting them down, particularly things like licensing and Article 4 in East London where I'm very active, and people just thinking some of the HMO regulations are just feel so disconnected from actually what's going on in the market and what tenants need. So we seem to be seeing business expectations from landlords falling quite steeply, I think. Is that what you're picking up as well?
Yes, our research shows that landlords' business expectations are at the lowest that they've been for more than 10 years. So this is really the bottom of where landlords' expectations are, and they don't see things improving in the near future. Obviously, a lot of that concern relates to the uncertainty around Brexit, uncertainty around economic circumstances. We're seeing, as was mentioned, demand falling in areas in London and the South East where there's perhaps a higher number of migrants and EU migrants living in those areas, and that demand has fallen with people feeling much less confident about their own futures in the UK. So I think that the regulation on top of that and the government's proposals to, for example, abolish Section 21 just make landlords feel like there's ever-increasing regulation and that the government is really taking a piecemeal approach to the regulation. They're not considering the whole, they're not considering what the future of the private rented sector should be in the long term, and therefore what model of regulation is needed as a much bigger piece.
Yes, now, Richard Bowser, you're ever the optimist, I know. And I wanted to ask you about how tax changes and mortgage regulation are kind of forcing landlords to chase perhaps higher yields and look at alternatives like serviced accommodation, for example.
Yes. In terms of the taxation, I think a figure of maybe 20% has been being factored in. Certainly, you know, in reference to the mortgage lenders, this is what is being looked at to ensure that landlords have got a viable business. A 20% increase in rents to offset against the increased taxation from the Section 24 tax. So, which necessitates obviously people saying, "Hang on a minute, you know, why am I in this business?" Now, that's all very well if you'd been in central London in 2012 you won't be worrying too much about your rental income as long as your mortgage finance costs were being paid, because you might have been seeing 10, 15, 20% capital appreciation for a few years and the value of your property. So your overall RIR, your return on your investment, is very much focused on the growth. But that's no longer the case, and it's probably unlikely in the near future for sure. So people have been, landlords have been, property investors have been chasing yield, and they've been looking at strategies such as serviced accommodation and other strategies as such, which enable them to achieve a greater income and be able to meet the tax bills.
And there's some talk of build to rent with their kind of amenity services of gyms and dining rooms and so on, kind of pushing up property standards. And some people worry that it's going to provide individual landlords with some quite steep competition. Other people argue that the build to rent sector is very small and it's not going to have that much of an impact. What are your thoughts on that?
I think with build to rent, you know, we just look at what's happened in the purpose-built student accommodation sector, which of course is built to rent, and it's been going. It's a much more mature phase than the build to rent for private tenants is at. We've been reporting in Property Investor News for about 15 years on the emergence of build to rent, and of course now it is something that most people who are in the sector have some understanding of. We've done some analysis quite recently to underline and that we feel, on our analysis, that the likely growth in terms of tenant demand is going to mean that the private landlords, providing they are taking the business seriously, that they'll be able to adapt to the build-to-rent sector. But it is certainly something, in my opinion, that's here to stay. We are going to see it. The level of investment has been relatively significant, but it's not proportionate to what is actually needed. But of course, the availability of land, planning regulations are all impediments to build to rent taking off at the sort of scale that is perhaps needed to meet the demand in the years ahead.
Lawrence, there were reports a year ago or so that first-time buyer borrowing was up by something like 10%. And, of course, Help to Buy has probably played into that. I was reading a news piece this morning about the National Audit Office study that found that only 30% of buyers who had bought through Help to Buy had actually, were actually helped by it, in the sense that they wouldn't have been able to buy if they hadn't used the scheme. What are your views on the impact that Help to Buy is having on the market?
So I think the National Audit Office question that they were asking, could these people have afforded to buy a home anyway? There's a lot of caveats and criteria to that question that you need to really dive into. There's a question of, if you've got a couple with one child and another child on the way, saying that, they could have bought a one-bed flat if they didn't use Help to Buy is not a helpful comparison. They could have bought a home, but it wouldn't have been a home that's appropriate for their needs. What Help to Buy has done in many cases is allow people to skip a rung on the housing ladder. And so the average home bought through Help to Buy is a 3 or 4 bed semi-detached house. That is not what you would normally think of as a first-time buyer sort of starter home. But in allowing people to skip that rung, to jump straight into that family property, people are able to set down roots for longer. They're able to set up a stable household, stable lifestyle, and grow into that home rather than buying a 1 or 2 bed flat and having to find somewhere to move 2 or 3 years down the line. So in that respect, it's been successful. It's helped to increase the number of first-time buyers. You mentioned that those numbers are still rising. The number of new homes delivered across England has been increasing very significantly since Help to Buy was introduced. So in those respects, it's been phenomenally successful. Whether we continue to see such strong support from government for Help to Buy is very much less certain. We heard in the budget last year that government was planning the sort of wind down and eventual end of Help to Buy. We've, of course, had the budget for this year cancelled, postponed. I'm not sure what the correct terminology is, so we're not yet sure what's coming up.
That was due to happen on the 6th of November, of course, yes, and that's been cancelled.
Yes, so the future of Help to Buy sort of from now is very much still uncertain. Robert Jenrick, the Secretary of State for Housing, has said all options remain on the table for supporting new housing delivery, so we could well see a stay of execution for the scheme beyond its current 2023 end date. But in terms of what Help to Buy is doing to the market, it's helping first-time buyers into home ownership and succeeding in its stated goals in that respect. It is perhaps drawing attention, it's drawing transactions away from the existing property market, which is an issue for those people who want to downsize or those people who want to, you know, transact for other reasons. And so I think we do possibly need to emphasise to government and to others that it's not just about new build, it's also about the wider housing market.
Richard, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, obviously it's had a beneficial effect in terms of ability of first-time buyers, and as Lawrence has said, for families moving up in terms of the ladder. But what it has had is a significant impact on the house building industry, which post 2008-2009 was in the doldrums, and lots of builders left the sector and haven't returned. So their skill sets have been lost, which obviously, you know, makes life difficult in terms of meeting, you know, demand. But at the same time, absolutely, demand has been driven, and house builders have responded. Perhaps, you know, there are obviously political questions about level of profitability of some of the house builders we've seen.
Some negative news as well. I was looking at the Persimmon reporting profits of $1 billion per year, the first time a developer has ever done that, so there's a kind of image issue there as well, I think, isn't there? I wanted to ask you, Richard, as well about auctions, because I know you go to a lot of auctions. I haven't been for about 6 months. What are they like at the moment? How busy are they? Because I often think they're the kind of pulse of the market in a way.
Absolutely. I mean, always property auctions being the barometer of the market. It's, if you think of the stock exchange and shares traded daily, etc., electronic trading instantly now. But in terms of getting your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the property sector in each region, go along to your local auction. I would say we've seen some surprisingly well-attended auctions in and around London in particular. Some of the Midlands auctions at the moment are absolutely, you barely can get in the room. I was looking at one last week at Aston Villa Football Club, and the attendance must have been, just at a glance, 700-800 people.
That sounds like London sort of 4 years ago.
Yes. So you can read into that, yes. But certainly the London auctions have been more subdued, but when I look at the sold, the percentage of sold, they're still pretty solid. I mean, auctioneers, as an auctioneer, you're very much judged by your potential vendors in terms of your ability to sell, and so the auctioneers are very cognizant of needing to keep the percentages up of lots sold, it's really just a question of price. If it's priced correctly, it'll sell.
Before I come back to Mira on some regulatory issues, Lawrence, I just wanted to ask you about stamp duty and the impact that's having. I mean, there were some briefings that Sajid Javid was thinking of switching the emphasis so that the seller had to pay it rather than the buyer. We know that stamp duty's had a big impact in prime central London, hasn't it? Where if you buy a property for over 1.5 million, you're paying 12% or 15% if it's an additional property, which it often is for those kind of buyers, isn't it?
It is, although it's important to remember this is a marginal tax rate, so you're only paying that 12% or 12% on the value above that threshold. But you're right, yeah, that the increase in stamp duty that we saw on higher value properties in 2014 did have a significant impact on the market. I think really the biggest impact that stamp duty changes have on the market is anticipation. And certainly right now what we're seeing is a lot of people, you know, calling up their agents or calling up the people they're trying to buy properties from and saying, well, should I wait? Because there's a chance that, you know, if Javid has been saying there's a possibility we're going to reform stamp duty, we're going to slash stamp duty below £500,000, that I should wait another 2 months and then buy afterwards. So that sort of speculation is deeply, deeply unhelpful for the housing market as a whole.
Yes, kind of adds to all of the uncertainty.
Yeah. Looking at the way stamp duty, the amount of money that stamp duty is bringing in order to make the sort of cuts that people have been speculating about or the sort of changes that people are talking about, would require the government to give up tax revenues of the order of £1 or 2 billion per year. Now, if there is a way for government to pick up that money elsewhere, then I'm sure they'll happily justify that. But Treasury is very keen on new measures to be revenue neutral or revenue positive. So be very careful what you wish for, because if you're not paying that money in stamp duty, they will try and take it out of you somewhere else.
And of course, the 3% additional rate has been rather handy in terms of filling the Treasury's coffers, hasn't it?
It does account for a decent chunk of the stamp duty revenue coming in, it's true.
So anyone who is hoping that might be abolished, I think, probably needs to think again. Okay, well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guest, Lawrence Bowles, research analyst at Savills, Mira Chindu-Roy, policy and public affairs manager at the National Landlords Association, and Richard Bowser, editor of Property Investor News. Meera, let's come on to the spectre of the abolition of Section 21. So this is no-fault eviction, which the government said it wanted to consult on. It was kind of the Theresa May government that set the ball rolling on this, wasn't it? The consultation ended on the 12th of October. And the NLA has undertaken research with Capital Economics on some of the potential economic impacts. What did the research find, Meera?
Yes, we did a survey of our members to see what this was before the consultation was actually published, but when it had been announced, to see what the impact would be on their decisions about their portfolios and their the way in which they would take their businesses forward. The key finding from that was that 43% of members said the most likely response that they would have to changes to Section 21, to the abolition of Section 21, would be to be more selective about the types of tenants that they would let to. Obviously, a significant proportion, around 10%, 10 to 15%, said that they would leave the market or they would reduce the size of their portfolios. And so that would also have an impact on supply. But I think the changes to the types of tenant is particularly important because the government has stated that their intention is to enable families and the sort of changing groups who are living in the private rented sector to be able to rent for longer periods. But actually, some groups will just not be able to agree a tenancy in the first place. So the research that we did was analysed by Capital Economics. They did an economic analysis of the research and extrapolated that to what it would mean for the wider landlord population. And it found that if the government goes ahead with abolishing Section 21 and doesn't take any mitigating factors in terms of reforming the courts, or reforming Section 8, there would be a drop of around a fifth of properties in the private rented sector. So that's almost a million dwellings which would no longer be available to rent.
And a huge drop in the number of properties available for people on benefits, is that right?
Yes, so a 59% fall in the percentage of properties of which would be available to people who are in receipt of benefits.
And it seems to me, Meera, that the government often forgets to think these things through when it comes to local authorities, because local authorities rely very heavily on private landlords supplying properties for them for their nominated tenants, often vulnerable tenants, people on benefits. And the government never seems to factor in what impact these things could have on them.
I would say that the consultation felt like it was rushed out a bit. It was very much a consultation, a policy position, which had been announced by the Theresa May government. The consultation came out a few days before Boris Johnson was announced as the new leader of the Conservative Party. And the actual consultation document, the questions in the document, we felt lacked a little insight into what actually happens in the private rented sector. So I think that what we encouraged our members to do, what we did in our response to the consultation, is to really highlight those issues and to show what the impact of this would be for people who are renting, and particularly, as you mentioned, for people who are either in receipt of benefits or who have poorer references or who have a history of poor credit, and who are going to find it much harder to rent a property when landlords are going to be much more risk averse.
The big question for us, Meera, is will it happen now? Because a lot of people think Boris is more kind of free market and probably wouldn't have followed through on a policy like this. Who knows who's going to be leading government in the next few months? Is it possible that this could just fall by the wayside?
Anything is possible. I think the Queen's speech didn't mention anything around this at all.
Nothing on housing, actually, in the Queen's speech. No. Whether the Queen's speech will ever get implemented is another question.
And the Boris Johnson government has been very quiet on the private rented sector. The focus has really been on house building and ownership. But that's not to say that it won't happen. I think the reality is that there is a shift in who's renting in the PRS. There are more families, there are people who are living in the private rented sector for much longer periods, if not for the entirety of their lives, which is quite a shift from what we see as the traditional private rented sector of a much more transient population. So the reality is that this government or the next government or a government in the future is likely to want to make changes. Whether they're the exact changes that were proposed in the consultation is another matter.
Yes, I mean, Lawrence, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, because this could mean lifelong tenancies, really. And it feels like kind of generation rent kind of holds all the influence now. Or, you know, charities like Shelter have been talking about this for many years. Has their time finally come, and what impact could that have on the market?
When we talk about generation rent, we've got to remember it's not just your traditional sort of image of these millennials or students living there. We're expecting to see an additional 1.5 million people in the private over the age of 65 living in the PRS by 2040. And so for these older households, and it's not just those people who have just, you know, hitting retirement ages, those people who are in their 70s and 80s as well, who are in the private rented sector, these are vulnerable people who need protections. And so it's natural for government to want to put some extra legislation in place to help protect these vulnerable people. But at the same time, you quite right need to strike a balance between that, protecting those residents, but also creating an environment that's conducive to people wanting to invest and create more rented homes. I think you are likely to see housing remain high on the political agenda for the next, well, certainly for the next decade, just given the focus that we've had on housing. You know, you don't have to look very far back for housing to have been top of the agenda previously, looking at schemes like Right to Buy and so on. So I think we can expect to be talking about this for many, many years to come.
And Richard, many landlords feel politically homeless. The NLA did some research a few months ago. 69% of landlords said they voted Conservative in 2017, but now only 25% said they would vote Conservative. And 89% said they would vote against any party that wants to bring in rent control, which means the Labour Party at the moment, doesn't it? And 85% said they would vote against, they wouldn't vote for any party that wanted to abolish Section 21, which means they wouldn't vote for any party, I don't think. Do you feel kind of politically homeless? Do you pick that up from other landlords?
Absolutely.
And investors?
Yeah, no, that is the case. It's you know, what is the better of various evils is the choice in terms of, you know, the vote at the ballot box ahead, which is possibly going to be sooner rather than later. The whole influence of the campaigning of the tenants' rights group, Generation Rents, as in particular, prior to the 2015 election, I think was really picked up. I remember talking to Conservative MPs some 6 or so years ago, and they were very clearly as focused on home ownership as being the overriding. How can we react to decline first-time buyer numbers, etc., and a lot of the prior to the 2015 election, a lot of the numbers around the growth of buy-to-let were very, very stark, and I think, you know, decisions were made and implemented by first of all by the coalition government and then by the Conservative government, which has led to what, you know, where we are now. But you know, the reality is there are 11.5 million tenants and 2.5 million landlords with 4.5 million properties or whatever, and the numbers are pretty, as from a politician looking at votes, that's pretty simple arithmetic to which constituency are you going to pander or lean more towards in terms of being seen to be favouring. But of course, you know, the unintended consequences have been mentioned earlier of decisions being making. You know, you mentioned about universal credit and Section 21. There are consequences, and maybe it's just short-term thinking. I think, as Mira mentioned earlier.
I mean, do you think we're stuck with this kind of anti-landlord dogma, Mira, for a generation?
A generation. I think it depends. I'm not going to have an answer, but it depends on what the future of the private rented sector will be and whether it meets the changing demands of the renters and of government. one of the biggest challenges we face as a landlords association is the perception of landlords and the negative perception of landlords. And we hear constantly from our members that they also struggle with that, and they want there to be more of the positive stories, because we know that the vast majority of renters do have a positive experience, because as Richard mentioned, there's over 11 million renters, but we only hear the negative experiences, which are a very small proportion of that. But that is something which is, it depends on landlords meeting those expectations and on the government taking an approach which recognises the value that landlords provide to the sector, while at the same time really taking strong action against the criminal landlords that are flouting the law.
And of course, housing charities would say that landlords have had it too easy too long. The law is skewed in favour of landlords with Section 21 and no-fault evictions and short-term tenancies, and that landlords have been very profitable during this decade of low interest rates, and that there are too many landlords that just operate below the radar, don't comply with regulation and so on, and that landlords have just brought this on themselves.
I would agree there's too many landlords that are able to get away with it, and that's because of the lack of enforcement and lack of resource for enforcement. And it means that those good landlords, which is the vast majority, suffer the consequences, which is really an unfortunate situation to be in, and means that landlords, all landlords, are having to answer for that small minority who behave appallingly. I think in terms of landlords having had the benefit of legislation in the past, or currently, there is a balance to be had, and we are strongly arguing that there should be reforms to the court system, because the court system isn't fit for purpose, and landlords use Section 21 because they generally wouldn't need to go through the court in order to receive possession. It's an administrative process, whereas the Section 8 process, the fault-based process, requires them to provide evidence, and they don't have confidence that the court will act in a timely manner, that it will be a reasonable cost, and that they will have the confidence that they're able to regain possession, even if they have the evidence that they should be able to regain possession, because the courts are inconsistent in their experience. So I think that any policy changes really need to take that into account, and it's not a matter of increasing tenants' rights at the expense of providing landlords with that confidence that they need to invest.
Yes, of course, the other argument that can be made is that landlords are being used as a scapegoat for the government's failure to build more council housing, or to ensure that more houses were built over the last kind of 30 to 40 years, really. Lawrence, I wanted to ask you about the regulation of letting agents. Obviously, you work for a well-known agency called Savills, and the working group that has been looking at this has recommended that all staff should be licensed, that agencies should be licensed as well, that all staff should have a qualification, and that there should be a regulatory code of practice and a regulator. How much is this going to change the sector, do you think, if it gets implemented?
Well, I think the first thing to sort of remember, and I think you speaking, asking the question from a landlord's perspective, you'll be aware of the sentiment as well. Nobody likes being regulated, particularly. And so these, to some extent, there is a bit of kickback against these proposed changes just on that basis. But you've got to remember the context of the situation as well. Government, and particularly the department, the Ministry for Housing, Communities and Local Government, is looking at this through a post-Grenfell lens, and they are sort of asking questions of letting agents and building managers to say, well, what are you doing to make sure that your tenants are safe? What are you doing to make sure that your residents are protected against the risk of fire, against the risk of property damage, and so on? And so having that regulation in place to try and protect those residents is absolutely key. Whether these proposed changes are the right way to doing it is still very much up for debate, as the various representative groups have been saying. But the argument that we need to be doing more to protect the safety of residents in the private rented sector, I think, is very much one that we have to stick by. What impact is that likely to have on the cost of renting and so on? I suspect, you know, we are going to see an increase in the fees that letting agents and managing agents are charging, because they can't charge those fees directly to tenants anymore. Will that have a knock-on impact on rents? I think where the market will bear it, we may see rents increase as a result of that. But there are certainly areas, as we've seen from those rental figures, where the market cannot accommodate an additional £200 a month to accommodate those fees. So it may be that in some cases landlords just have to grin and bear it.
And Richard, letting agents have been described as the Wild West of the private rented sector. Some people argue that we're likely to see a kind of consolidation in the letting agent sector where smaller ones get gobbled up by larger ones. What sort of changes can you see coming in the future for letting agents?
Yeah, there is a shakeout already occurring. When government interferes in a marketplace, it has consequences. And a lot of the rationale behind increasing regulation, increasing enforcement, is down to negative publicity. And I think the larger organisations will and are gobbling up smaller ones that are not able to adapt are exiting, because it just becomes an uneconomic proposition. But it's just been mentioned, if there are increased costs, those costs are either going to be borne by private landlords or, and particularly in respect to the taxation changes as well, which many small, when we talk about small portfolio, landlords with maybe 2, 3, 4 properties who are in full-time careers, and if all of a sudden they realise that there isn't prospect of capital growth ahead, their net income is declining, and then post-tax, in some cases, it's disproportionate to all of the burden. And then the letting agents are also, demanding more, then some landlords inevitably are going to vote with their feet and get out of the sector. And obviously it's still anecdotal. I mean, I've yet to see any clear evidence of a mass exodus. I remember talking to you a few years ago at an event about a survey that the NLA had done that forecast, half a million landlords would be exiting the sector by now. I'm not sure that we've seen that, but there is no question that that the compounding effect of Section 24, the tenant fees, licensing, it is all having a detrimental effect, and has already been mentioned on landlord confidence.
Lawrence, I wanted us to finish off on the impact of Brexit, and I've kind of modelled in my own mind different impacts. So if we had no deal, I have a frequent conversations with Shaheen, who runs my corner shop on my street. And it's not my corner shop, it's his corner shop, but it's on my street. And he always asks me, what's happening with Brexit? How's it going to affect house prices? And what I say to him roughly is, well, if we have no deal, I think they'd start falling a bit more. If we do have a deal, I think they kind of stay where they are for a bit and then probably recover. If Article 50 were revoked, I think we'd see a bounce in prices. Do you think that makes any sense, that sort of analysis?
I think we'd broadly agree with the rationale there. I think the core to all of this, I would say, is that the housing market doesn't like uncertainty. And so the more certainty you can bring to the housing market, the stronger price performance you will see. If you see a no-deal Brexit, a disorderly Brexit, that is a situation that we've never been in before. Nobody quite understands what's going to happen, and so we would expect to see much weaker performance in the housing market following that. If we were to arrange some kind of deal and get it through Parliament and overcome all these hurdles that have kept us busy for so long, then that gives us a much clearer position of what to expect, and we might expect to see stronger performance there. Revocation is an interesting one. Because I think there it depends on the grounds and the, you know, the circumstances of revoking Article 50. If we see Article 50 revoked because we have a Lib Dem, Joe Swinson is Prime Minister, and we're all very keen to stay in and engage fully with the EU, then I think, you know, investment returns to the UK, everybody's very confident again, as we can all wake up and pretend it never happened. If we see Article 50 revoked as a way to reset the clock and sort of rethink things before submitting it again.
More uncertainty.
Greater uncertainty. Yes. And so continued uncertainty and continued weak performance, exactly.
What about pent-up demand? I've heard you talk about that before, and, you know, this idea that once Brexit is done, this pent-up demand would suddenly be unleashed on the market. The difficulty is we don't know exactly whether or not that pent-up demand is there, do we?
It's difficult to quantify, just because, well, even looking at the market as it stands at the moment, it's difficult to quantify exactly what's going on with cash buyers. We have a lot of data for mortgage buyers because we have UK Finance tracking all of the mortgages being granted, but for cash buyers, it's all, you have to sort of make things up using calculating what's happening with stamp duty, what's happening with HMRC registrations and so on. So we suspect that there are a number of people who are keen to buy, cash investors in particular, who are keen to buy but are waiting for greater certainty, or they're waiting for prices to fall just that little bit more, or waiting for just the right discount before they pull the trigger. The conditions that they need to actually go ahead with that purchase will vary from person to person. And so whether we see a tsunami of transactions spreading across the entire market as soon as there's a deal agreed, or if we see actually just a gentle resurgence of housing transactions back to sort of more normal pre-referendum levels, I think we're going to have to wait and see exactly what happens there. But I think looking at the mortgage side of the market, the demand is still very much there. The lenders are lending as much as they can given mortgage regulations. We are not likely to see those regulations relaxed, and I don't think there's any sort of capacity there for a huge upshot in the number of mortgage transactions.
And Mira, the economy is sluggish. The present government are talking about wanting to stimulate the economy to get us through any kind of possible Brexit dip. Given the fears that abolishing Section 21 could cause some landlords to leave the market, is it possible that that's just an idea that they would be more likely to shelve given the need to stimulate the economy?
I think it's hard to predict. Definitely at the moment, Section 21 isn't the first thing on the agenda, shall we say. I think the concerns about making changes to the market and what that might, the impact that that might have on the sector, may well be raised, but it's so hard to predict at the moment because we don't even know what government we're necessarily going to have in December. So I would be very wary of making any assertions about what is going to happen in the future.
And Richard, if I could ask you a kind of Brexit related question on interest rates. Michael Saunders, who's a member of the Rate Setting Committee at the Bank of England, said at the end of September in a speech in Barnsley that the economy's persistent weakness meant a delay to Brexit or even a last minute deal could still leave policymakers with no option but to cut rates. Have you been getting trackers or fixed rates recently? Because I got a couple of trackers actually in the hope that I might get a bit of an interest rate cut in the forthcoming months.
Yeah, if we look at borrowing costs, which, I mean, they're the lowest in my lifetime, they're the lowest interest rates we've seen, bank rate, you know, in 300 odd years. It's incredibly low in the context of the last 20, 30 years, where we've been in the last 10 years. So borrowing costs are incredibly low. I think in terms of the interest rate direction, you know, we don't need to look too far across the channel to see, you know, what's happening in some of our European counterparts, where in some parts of the world we've got negative interest rates.
Yes, minus 0.5, yes. I think, in the European Bank, isn't it, at the moment? Yes.
So, it's very much, the word uncertainty is absolutely prevalent in the moment. So, where we go from here, but certainly, I mean, this phrase lower for longer has been bandied around quite some time, and I can't see that changing anytime soon in terms of lower interest rates for much longer. Whether we go into unknown territory in the UK context into negative rates is we'll see.
And I would certainly recommend that investors do kind of forward planning modelling on the basis of rates going up at some point to 2.5-3%, just to make sure that the business stays sustainable. Well, that's it for this programme. You can find all 24 editions of Inside Property and get in touch with us via our website, insideproperty.org.uk. Many thanks to my guests, Richard Bowser, Meera Chinduroy and Lawrence Bowles, and thanks to you for listening.